Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are. This week, Lena Horne and Walter Hickel have died. As far as we know, there's no connection. If you don't know who Lena Horne was, you're young. If you do know who Walter Hickel was, not so much. A small city with a few contracts in Arizona has declared a boycott because of that state's anti-immigrant law. The city? Los Angeles. How much could it cost Arizona? Just $56 million. Small change during a recession, especially in a state where the government has asked for a sales tax increase because the government has a deficit. It's just $56 million. If you wish to, you can hurt British Petroleum. Your choice. Meanwhile, they've come up with a plan. Let's put a pipe in the hole and pump the oil into a ship. Yeah, then we can get all the kids to show their talent while the crew's working. We can put on a show. The old joke is, what do they call newlywed salad? It's lettuce alone without dressing. Now it might be, how do you prevent getting an E. coli infection? How about lettuce alone without handling? We'll explain. The euro went down today, supposedly because of concerns over the rescue of Greece's economy and the risk that the same might have to be done for a couple of other Western European nations. Okay, take your guess. What effect should this have on the U.S. stock market tomorrow? Up? Down? No effect? Anyone? Bueller? First-time unemployment claims fell again, but complaints are being heard that they didn't drop enough, and that this is a bad sign for the economy. Hey guys, this is the fourth straight week of drops in first-time claims. This is good news. Some people just can't take yes for an answer. Massachusetts is about to require retailers to post graphic warnings about cigarette smoking, including pictures of badly damaged teeth that sometimes results from smoking. Remind me not to shop right around lunch. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. We've got all that, news of the weird, and our special guest, Joel Blackwell, to talk about grassroots politics when there's no election pending. Also, after a long vacation, a return of the end point essay. But first, we had a question today being asked of us by someone we know kind of peripherally, an acquaintance rather than a friend, who was talking and asking about mobile home investment, about which I know a little something. And so I referred him, and I'd like to refer you to a website where you can read the book that I wrote called Mobile Millionaire. You'll be able to see an excerpt of the book and determine if you wish to buy it, of course, but you can at least see an excerpt and find out a little bit about investing in mobile home for the small investor with little or no money. And the website, because now I know you have your pen or pencil poised or your fingers on the keyboard, is mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. And as said, the book deals with those subjects and how to make choices, how little it can cost to buy a mobile home and rent it out, and so forth. So I would recommend to you that you go to the site, no obligation. We don't capture your IP address. And if you wish to address someone by saying IP, that's, of course, up to you, but there's your choice. In any event, that's the website, mobilemillionaire.blogspot, and the ever-popular .com. Wanted to talk to you about those headlines, and we've got some really good stories from News of the Weird, and we'll come to those in a minute. But first, the death this week of Lena Horne is significant. What's surprising is she was 92 years old. It seems like a rather short time ago to me that she appeared on 60 Minutes with the late Ed Bradley, and she was just in her 70s then, so that demonstrates time is passing a lot faster than I would have hoped. But Lena Horne, besides being a singer, jazz, pop, blues, not really blues, I guess jazz and pop, was also an actress. And for those who don't know, she was African-American. And she made a mark for herself by refusing parts that were offered to her by the studio to which she was under contract, when the parts were, she felt, demeaning, such as the maid, or the period pieces, slaves. She wouldn't take those parts, and she had a desire to make sure that African American actors and actresses were treated with dignity. As a result, her acting career suffered, but her self-respect flourished. Walter Hickel. We would ask for a show of hands of everyone who heard of Walter Hickel, or in the case of our producer, a show of paws. But Walter Hickel was the governor of Alaska. Normally, we hear people say somebody was the former something of something. Someone, for example, that Sarah Palin, who wanted to be named Paler, by the way, was the former governor of Alaska. No, she is the former governor of Alaska. Is said because she will always, in the present tense, be the former governor of Alaska unless she runs for and gets elected to that office again. But now that Walter Hickel has died, we can say that when he was alive, he was the former governor of Alaska. In any event, he was the governor of Alaska until he was appointed by Richard Nixon to be the Secretary of the Interior in Nixon's administration. Hickel served in that position and did a lot of what environmentalists would consider damage, in that he always strived to open up lands for drilling and exploration, oil extraction, and so forth. But he is largely remembered by those who remember him at all for a highly moral stance he took with regard to what occurred in May of 1970. Some of you will remember that May 4th, 1970 was the date on which the occurrences took place at Kent State University in Ohio, when the National Guard troops opened fire on some protesters who were not themselves being violent and killed, I don't know, 3 students, I think it was. Hickel, after that happened, wrote a letter to Nixon, which ended up getting published later, in which he said that he thought the president was not being sensitive to the mood of the country and the desires and wishes of young people, as was evidenced by the protests at Kent State and Jackson State University. And Nixon, of course, fired him, wanting to have no one in his cabinet who wasn't 100% supporter. And Hickel maintained that view and ultimately was against the Vietnam War before everybody was and before most Republicans were. He, at that point, had a level of respect from those who disagreed with him on matters he handled at the Department of Interior. So that's the story of Walter Hickel. He died in his 90s, and this was, again, during the last week. I don't remember whether he was 91 or 93, but he was obviously an older man. And he stayed in politics in Alaska for quite some time and was an early supporter of Sarah Palin, who later found himself not a great supporter, a great fan, when she ran for vice president. And showed her level of intellect, I guess. But that's Walter Hickel, and for those of you who don't remember him, now you know a little something about him you didn't know before. British Petroleum. Most people do not know this, but British Petroleum, BP as it's being called, and as its initials indicate, is, of course, responsible for the oil spill, or at least is one of the responsible parties for the oil spill in the Gulf Coast area. What most people don't know is that British Petroleum is the owner of ARCO gas stations. Now, I shop at ARCO sometimes, but of late I haven't. And one of the reasons is because it's difficult to justify contributing to the profits of a company that can't spend money on preventing such an occurrence. So it's obviously up to you. I'm not suggesting a boycott. If I were going to suggest a boycott, I would suggest you'd boycott the state that I'm in, Arizona, for reasons that we'll talk about. But British Petroleum owns ARCO. If you don't wish to enrich BP, don't shop at ARCO. I don't recall the name of the stations that BP owns outside the West. It could be BP. I don't know. So anyone who is listening who wishes to let us know that, of course, we'd welcome your input. Which reminds me, the phone number here, if you wish to participate in the conversation, either now or when Joel Blackwell joins us, is 347-994-3796. Now, that would be referred to as a good segue had I planned it. But since I didn't, it's just a strange reminder to self. In any event, that is the phone number. If you wish to join us again, 347-994-3796. We talked about the lettuce problem. There's an E. coli infection going around the country. It's now spread to 4 states. And if you consume something with the E. coli bacteria, you usually won't feel very good. You may not get really sick. You probably won't die. That's encouraging, isn't it? But you may very well be sick to your stomach and have to take a lot of trips down the hall. Well, as I said, that bacteria has now spread to 4 states. It's spread by lettuce that has been provided by a wholesaler from Yuma, Arizona. If you hear any growling in the background, by the way, that's our producer, Autumn Bushman, who is apparently objecting to my talking about the lettuce. In any event, yes, you tell them, that's right. The lettuce that's being spread about, as I say, comes from a wholesaler in Yuma. And basically, it's bagged lettuce that is so distributed. And today, some expert came out and said, if you buy lettuce in a supermarket, take it home, wash it, cut it, whatever you're going to do, and then eat it, you are virtually safe. You really have nothing to worry about in terms of that. But because this lettuce is wholesaled to restaurants, the real problem comes about when you are obtaining lettuce in places like a salad bar or a restaurant or something like that. So the basic thrust of that is if you buy lettuce in a supermarket, you're safe. In a salad bar, perhaps not as much. We happened to mention a while ago the euro being down today and asked you if you could take a guess as to how that might affect the stock market tomorrow. The truth is nobody knows these things, but here's my bet for what it's worth. Not that you should invest money based on my bet, because I guarantee you my opinion is no better than anyone else's. Or at least I like to sound humble and say that. But the euro going down means a number of things. One of them is that the dollar is up. If the dollar is up, that means that Americans can buy a lot more foreign goods and so forth, which is in one sense good for the dollar and good for the United States and good for the United States economy. On the other hand, it's not great, because it means that our goods are more expensive in other countries. When you count, for example, if let's say for a moment, this is not accurate, but let's say that previously 1 euro would buy $1. If the value of the euro is down by 50%, which it is not, it means it takes 2 euros to buy something that costs a dollar here. And therefore, we will sell fewer exported goods. Forgive my laughter, but the producer, who's a Chihuahua, is playing around the sumptuous studio here at the BBC. That's the Bushman Broadcasting Center. And, of course, this is what happens when you do live radio. So in terms of what the stock market is likely to do tomorrow, the greatest likelihood, I think, is that it'll go up, but not enormously. Part of that is because of the euro-dollar relationship, which is to say that now the dollar is stronger and it's generally considered better for our economy, with certain limitations, as I mentioned, but also because the market was down today by about 144 points. So that's my guess. You can make a determination as to whether it's right or not, and if I'm wrong, you can, of course, gloat next week. There's an interesting old story, and I'm not sure whether it's apocryphal, but there was the way the story went is some clever guy at a time when you could still get mail to somebody in one day was sending mail to a bunch of investors that I don't know where he got the list, but these were supposedly very wealthy people. And what he did is he took 1,000 of these names, and to 500 of them, he mailed an envelope in which he put a piece of paper, and the one word written on the piece of paper was, to 50% of them, up. And to the other 50% of them, it was down. When the market went up, he eliminated the 50% of his list to whom he had sent the word down. And the next day, he divided the remaining 500 the same way, 50% up, 50% down. By the fifth day, those who had happened to have gotten all of the right answers as to what the stock market was going to do, he didn't say, I'm talking about the stock market or I'm talking about art or whatever, or gold, just up or down. Clearly, many of the people knew that, or figured out that he was talking about the stock market, because that was the only thing about which what he was saying was true. And again, he only continued the mailings to those for whom the note was correct. So at about the third or fourth day, he wrote a note to the people who had gotten the right answers, and he said, you know now that I can tell you whether the market will go up or down from what I've been sending you accurately. If you're interested in my doing that for you, please send me X number of dollars, and here's the address, or give me a call. And supposedly he got a lot of clients. It's an interesting marketing tool, you have to admit, even though it's obviously fraudulent. And no, it wasn't Bernie Madoff. The first-time unemployment claims, we talked about, they're down again. Last week they talked about continuing unemployment claims being down as well. And then what happened was this week that story has not come out about continuing unemployment claims yet. But it's rather obvious that we're in an economy that is doing better overall, and that the employment picture is about to turn around. Although we talked about this last week, let me mention again that the fact that the unemployment rate went up, even though jobs are being produced and first-time unemployment claims are going down, has to do with the fact that people who have been out of work are seeing that their friends are getting work and that the economy is improving, and they figure, well, okay, now I'll start looking for work again. As soon as they do that, it kicks the unemployment rate up, because the unemployment rate relates to the number of people who are actively looking for work and can't find it, for full-time work, and can't find it. So that's basically what's happening there. Wanted to talk about some great stories from News of the Weird. News of the Weird is a website. They also produce a column for a number of newspapers syndicated around the country. You can either go to newsoftheweird.com or newsoftheweird.blogspot.com and read some very strange stories and see some very odd video. But in the meantime, if you have a business and you're not blogging, you ought to be. Blogging is the best way to drive eyeballs to your website and dollars to your bottom line. If you want to know more, go to jeffonblogging.blogspot.com and read about how you can either do it yourself for nothing, that is to say blogging, or have it done by a professional writer very inexpensively. Again, that's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com, and who the Jeff is in that address, I'm too modest to tell you. News of the Weird. The American Academy of Pediatrics, this is a horrible story, I tell you up front. If you're a little squeamish, you might want to think about either crossing your legs or not putting your fingers in your ear for a minute. But the American Academy of Pediatrics is trying to outthink the Africans and Asians now living in the United States who come from cultures that require declitorizing their daughters. That Academy of Pediatrics is pushing physicians to advise the most closed-minded of them to settle for jabbing the girls with a pinprick in the clitoral area rather than the much worse organ slicing. It's a disgusting and terrible story, obviously. But the strange part about it is, I mean, everything about it is strange, but what I was going to say is that there are women's rights activists who are suggesting that even talking about settling for less of an abusive tactic is really not that great. That's like, in some sense, saying it's okay if you only hit your wife once instead of beating her up. Hitting her once is lousy, too, and clearly abusive, as is this, at least by our standards, and I think our standards in this case are right, at the risk of sounding ethnocentric. The governor of the Russian Republic of Kalmykia, which sounds like a name somebody would have made up for a Peter Sellers movie, but the governor of the Russian Republic of Kalmykia came clean last week that he was, in fact, abducted from his apartment by space aliens in front of three witnesses who conversed with him telepathically since their ears were hurting from inadequate oxygen. Now, one member of Russia's parliament was very concerned not because the governor's crazy, but because that while abducted, he might have given away state secrets. He said that in the parliament. That would be the Duma. By the way, we've got about 4 or 5 minutes before John joined. I can't talk. By Joel Blackwell, who will be talking to us, as I mentioned, about grassroots politics without it necessarily being related to an election. Okay, I've got two stories left. I'm not sure which I'll have time for, so I'm going to give you the one that I like best. A man was arrested and charged recently, according to reports, for having sex with an octopus, a dead octopus. Now, I'm not making this up, but I don't know absolutely if it's true since it wasn't on CNN for some reason. But having sex with a dead octopus sounds like a lovely romantic interlude. Now, we can imagine the song he sang her. We have to assume the octopus was female because we don't want to accuse the gentleman of being gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But anyway, the song, how about, "Put your arms around me, baby, hold me tight." That goes, never mind. Maybe they just danced. I'm not sure. Okay, it looks like we may have time for the last story. There is an anti-gay activist by the name of George Wreckers. You'll all remember his son, Home Wreckers. Anyway, he has been legislating or lobbying for legislation against gay people adopting children. In any event, it turns out that he managed to obtain the services of what is called a rent boy. There is a website with the word rent boy in the name. And from there, he got someone to escort him on a trip he took, carry his baggage, so to speak. And Wreckers had this young man with him on his trip, and he kept changing his story about the vacation. Kept changing his story as he, again, this is from News of the Weird, they call it as he's going through various stages towards self-acceptance. But anyway, late last week, he was past the sex, what sex, and I didn't know Lucian, the gentleman's name, was gay, and is now saying, "I knew he was gay. I was using our 2-week vacation in Europe to bring him to God." Okay, now, that's all from News of the Weird on that story. Here's my take. You can imagine the dialogue between them, okay? "Oh, God, I'm coming. To God. I'm on my way to God." Okay. Anyway, that's News of the Weird. If you'd like to join us, the number here is 347 area code, 994-3796. It's probably cruel to ask Joel to jump in right after that story because it's so stupid, but there you go. He'll be joining us momentarily. Meantime, wanted to tell you, if you are at all interested in jazz, and if you're like most Americans, you're not, but if you're at all interested in jazz of any kind, I'd like to commend to your attention a website that was recently brought to my attention, jazzradio, one word, .com. And on the site, there are different kinds of jazz that you can have played for you, that is, various recordings. There's swing and big band, there's bossa nova or Brazilian jazz, there is Sinatra, sound-alikes, there's all kinds of things, and I'm obviously not remembering all of them, so I would recommend to you that you consider taking a look at jazzradio.com. Don't do it during the show, stop that, but afterwards or tomorrow, take a listen. If you don't like jazz, you might want to take a listen anyway. You might find some things that interest you. I didn't mention there's a Latin jazz section, which I happen to like, as well as the swing section. But whatever it is you like, it's there. It's available to you. And the best part, of course, is it's free, if you don't count the fact that you have to listen to an occasional commercial. Very, very well done. And I think you'll enjoy it. Also, if you are into radio, and obviously you are, let me suggest to you another site called radiotime.com. While you can't hear this show there, you can hear all kinds of radio stations on that website, and that would include a variety of NPR stations, as well as all kinds of talk stations. There's even a section that deals with books and the spoken word. You can also hear music of various kinds, stations all around the country, and that's that. And finally, in terms of radio sites that you might like, is Receiva, R-E-C-E-I-V-A, .com. I think it's .com. In any event, they have a similar kind of setup to Radio Time, but they have radio stations from all over the world. I have heard Radio Australia, Radio New Zealand, the BBC in its various formats, as well as jazz from a variety of countries, one of which was Russia. And the music is, of course, perfectly fine, because you don't have to understand Russian to listen to the music. But it's kind of interesting slash amusing to hear someone announce the song that you just heard played, and then hear, I can't speak Russian, but it sounds something like, Caravan Duke Ellington. And so if that interests you, not necessarily jazz, but all kinds of radio, Receiva.com is something else I'd recommend to you. And that's basically all we had on radio. We, as I said, are expecting to hear from Joel momentarily. As a matter of fact, we're expecting to hear from him now. So presumably he's on his way to the phone and will be joining us momentarily, as you can, at 347-994-3796. In fact, we have a call, and let's see and let's hope. Joel, is that you?
That is Joel.
Oh, how are you, sir?
I am doing very well and ready to rock and roll.
Okay, well, I'm not sure about the rolling, but we can certainly rock. Anyway, Joel is the author of a book on the subject of, oddly, it's not in front of me, anyway, on the subject of grassroots politics. And would you call yourself an organizer?
Well, I think of myself as empowering people, because many times they don't understand the power an individual can have when they're speaking to the person they can vote for.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it starts with the fact that, well, let me back up a little further. I ran for office some years ago, and I was amazed at how few people are paying attention to campaigns and politics. And when you're out campaigning and you actually run across somebody who cares and maybe even wants to ask a few questions, you just want to grab them and hug them. It's so rare. And so in my campaign, I managed to hold my opponent to 76% of the vote. So I did not go into office. But it started me on a quest to figure out, what is this relationship between voters and politicians? How does it work?
Sure.
And so I did a lot of research and found that when a politician is talking to a person who can vote for them, it's a very powerful moment.
And in terms of that moment, let me back up a moment with you. Besides
sure.
the engaging the politician who is seeking your vote, you've also been involved in some other areas in terms of the political process, correct?
Well, what I do is basically work with organizations who are trying to mobilize a grassroots operation, yes. Now,
mm-hmm.
it tends to be any kind of an operation. I've worked with farmers, I've worked with nurses, I've worked with community action agencies. And so you start with the individual, but you have to have you work within an organization of some kind, because whether you're working at the state or the federal level, you have to get enough political weight in a legislature or in the Congress to make something happen. So it does take an organization, but it starts with the individual, and that's what my book is about. It's personal political power.
And let's talk about your book. The title... Where someone can get it. We'll talk about it again before we end, but I wanted to touch on it now.
Oh, sure. The title of the book is Keep On Voting After the Election.
Right.
And if they search for that, or if they search for Joel Blackwell, they will find the book. It's available on Amazon, and they'll even find me, and I'll sell them one. But the point is that...
Go ahead.
You know, the point is that most people only think about influencing the government on election day, if they think about it at all. And my
right.
point is that your letter or your phone call, particularly now, between now and election day, they're really listening. So now is the best time to influence them. You don't have to wait till election day.
Right, because most people, the only input, if you will, that we have in the process is voting, or if you're really enthusiastic about somebody, sending them a little check. Or big check.
Yeah, you might do that. And not very many people do either one of those. And as we know, usually fewer than 50% of the people vote in a general election. And if you roll it back to primaries, in a lot of districts in this country, only about 10% of the eligible voters will turn out in a primary. And in most districts in the country, the primary is the election. Whoever's going to be elected there gets elected. And so that's why we have the polarization in Congress and the legislatures these days, because only about 10% of the voters, you know, on the right in the red places and the left in the blue places, those are the people that politicians are listening to.
Right. And to carry your point out, allow me to extrapolate from what you're saying, the people who vote in the primaries are going to always be those who are the most committed to their own views. And those, therefore, tend to be somewhat more extreme, and that's the reason for the polarization, because people on both the left and the right tend to be more extreme than would be the case if more people participated.
Well, that's true, and what's important for people who maybe aren't voting in primaries is that after these people are elected, in other words, to keep on voting after Election Day, or to vote now, vote today, most of those issues which the people on the far right and left are thinking about are, you know, things that aren't going to change very much anyway. I mean, abortion, gun control, these social issues, that's not going to change very much. And
right.
But all your other stuff, the things that you care about, health care and some of the other things, you can make a real difference today on that kind of an issue.
Okay. Well, tell us how, if for example, we can make something up. We think there ought to be trash collection 2 days a week. Or a more concrete example, as a matter of fact, there are places in America that have no curbside recycling program. Someone wants to do something with that in brief form. Tell us what they would do to go about doing that.
Okay, then that's a very good choice, because there are plenty of places where they do that, and we can see what the effect is if you choose to have curbside recycling. And so what you need to do is find out who in your locality can make it happen. Let's say it's the city council. You need to call the voter registrar, or call the library, or call City Hall. Find out, you know, who can you vote for? And then you call that person. And what surprises people is that that person will want to talk to them. It's amazing. They don't get that many calls. They don't get that many calls from people who have something sensible to talk about and who have studied a little bit and have a recommendation. And here's the other thing that people don't realize. Your average city council member or state senator or member of Congress, they don't care one way or another. I mean, they just really don't care. It's not going to affect their life. And so they're willing to go with the flow. And what I'd like to say is, you have to create the flow. And it is amazing. 5 or 10 phone calls from concerned citizens, I promise you, will get the attention of any city council member.
Sure. Because the concern is that every one of those calls could represent a lot more votes, because it's the most committed people who are going to make the calls, correct?
They actually have in their mind, and they have been trained by political parties and in other places, there's information, they have in their mind specific numbers. I videotaped an interview with a member of Congress one time who, on the videotape, said, "We know from studies that every letter we get represents 150 people who did not write but feel the same way."
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, it does have an impact. And like I say, you know, they don't care whether you have recycling or not. They just want to please you. They want to get your vote next time. And many of them, you know, are looking for something to do, some issue to ride. So they love it when constituents call in and say, "We'd like you to pick up the flag and lead the charge." They love that.
Yeah. I will share with you, about a million years ago, when I lived in California and was a process server, I actually got a city council.
You must have been the most loved man in town.
Yeah, actually, you'd be surprised that it was not that bad. That's a whole other story for a different show on a different day. But it really wasn't that terrible in terms of people being upset, but except on rare occasions. But what I was going to say is that I got a city council member to actually consider and draft. It never ended up getting introduced for other reasons. Actually, he was written out of office because of some things he had done unrelated to this. But I actually got a city council member to draft legislation to make it a crime, I don't know what you would call it, a city violation of law to assault a process server, specifically to have, it would be a misdemeanor, even though assault is a felony, but it would be additional charge. He actually drafted it at my request. In this particular case, I had no additional clout. And not only that, I was probably 18. The point you're making is exactly right. They will listen to you and they will consider doing something that you want done for the reasons that you're talking about.
Well, and the missing piece there was convincing evidence that anybody else cared about process servers. Now, in my model...
yeah, very much like cockroaches in that sense. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, but here's what I would have recommended had I been your consultant at the time. I would have said, okay, you got to find some more process servers, and I'm sure there were some more,
right?
And some other people who care about process servers, lawyers and people like that, and you got to get them to make a few calls too. And at that point, you at some level, you hit a tipping point because there's probably also not that many people who would be against it because they don't care. I mean, who's going to defend assaulting process servers? So all that was missing was you needed to form an organization and get some other people involved.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm sure that's true. Now, let me ask you a question that's kind of like flip side of the coin here. As you know, there is a large movement. How large is open to question, but there's a large amount of activity anyway with respect to the Tea Party, the teabaggers, activists on the right. Okay. When you are seeing something like that, and I don't know what your politics are. I mean, when you said you ran for office, I don't know if it was as a Democrat or as a Republican.
Oh, well, I will tell you right quickly. I work for the Green Party. I work for the Green Party. If their money's green, I'll take it.
That's funny. Well, and you did manage to snatch 24% of the vote, so that's not to be sneered at. But
hey, look, I know what I am. Okay, we're just talking about the price.
That's right. I understand. But the thing I was going to ask you is, in terms of you see a movement like that, and when I say you, when one sees a movement like that, and one would prefer that not happen or not gain sway, from your standpoint, what besides, feeling frustrated and sometimes amused, what do you do? What do you do to combat that?
Well, let's first of all take a look at what's going on there. And I will be surprised. In the first place, the Tea Party folks are engaged in campaigns and election, and that is one set of activity that that I do not pretend to know a whole lot about. However, what I observe is that they're kind of unfocused, in terms of issues and things like that. They're mad about a lot of stuff. They're mad as hell. They're not going to take it anymore. But if you were to interview 100 of them, they'd have 100 different things they're mad about. So while it's true, they are able to have some impact in primaries and within the Republican Party because a small number of people can do that. In terms of actually influencing legislation and making changes in policy, it will be very interesting to see because, like many movements like this, number one, they're not particularly well-focused, and number two, what are they going to do after Election Day? You even saw, on the flip side of this, for example, President Obama had this incredible grassroots organization. Nobody had ever seen anything like it, the number of people engaged. And I said at the time, and I say now, wait till it comes to trying to pass legislation and see how many show up. And they're not showing up, and they are not acting.
Right.
Because they were supporting the rock star that they loved, fine, but they're not participating in the grassroots keep on voting after the election activities to make legislation happen.
Right.
So back to the Tea Party folks, on the one hand, it'll be interesting to see how much impact they have in getting legislation passed, in addition to how much impact they actually have on elections. But, you know, they will have some. Clearly, there's something big going on there. I mean, a lot of disgruntled people and the political system, and this proves our democracy works, the political system is responding to those angry people. So that's in a good thing if you're one of them. Now, if you don't like their issues, what you got to do is you got to mount a counter pressure, and you've got to be more focused and more organized than they are. And you have to focus on specific issues, which is where where they are not as strong as they might be otherwise. And so, for example, just take immigration. You know, maybe you're unhappy with what's going on in Arizona.
In Arizona.
Okay, there must be quite a few people in Arizona who are not happy. And where are their voices? And how are they going to make them heard? Well, I can promise you that if a lot of registered voters were calling the people they can vote for and saying, we don't like this, and explaining why, that could be turned around. It's also true.
Although I'm not sure about your specific example, certainly what you say generally is true. You're talking about a state where the fact is that the anti-immigrant sentiment here is enormous.
Well, that's what I mean. I said, if enough. Now, the point is, if 50% plus one of Arizonans like that law, then that is democracy in action.
Unfortunately, yes. As a matter of fact, the essay that I have prepared for the end of the show talks about that kind of thing, about majority rule.
Yeah.
But I won't bore you with it now. I'll bore the listeners
okay.
later.
That's okay. You know, at some point it does become majority tyranny, and there's the rub. This is what we wrestle with.
Yeah.
There's the rub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny you should say that. I swear to you, this is a very weird coincidence. It's called tyranny of the majority.
Well, yeah,
which is an old phrase, obviously, but it happens to be the title I selected for the thing. But go ahead, please.
It's been around a while, and there's a very good reason for that. And you know, one of the other things that that I try to help people with is in terms of understanding real politics and how things really work is they think that money is the principal driver in politics,
and it's not.
Well, it is a driver, and I encourage people to use money. But here's an interesting thought for you. I have interviewed hundreds of lobbyists, hundreds of politicians, hundreds of volunteer advocates, hundreds of academic researchers, and everybody in that chain says they don't like the way money works. The lobbyists wish that they could simply go in and become honest advocates. The politicians don't like begging for money. People don't like writing checks. However, what we have is a free enterprise political system. Our politicians have to go out to the open marketplace and raise money to run for office.
Right.
So if the Tea Party people wanted to make a real change, and I think this probably would not appeal to them, but if they really wanted to make a change, they would be arguing for public financing of campaigns to get the money out of campaigns.
Right, except they don't want the money out of campaigns, as you noted. It wouldn't appeal to them. They don't want the money out of campaigns because they want to be able to influence campaigns by their use of money.
Well, you know, I don't get a sense that the Tea Party people are moneyed people for the most part.
No, that's true. Yeah.
So I think it is. I think again, it's hard to say what they stand for. They're just mad as hell. But my point is that a good grassroots operation can overcome the influence of money. Because any of the people contributing to a politician can't vote for that politician. And a small number of voters, you know, who are focused, no politicians wants to make people mad and go around saying, my guy doesn't listen to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because what you're really talking about is that there are two emotions or concerns that a politician has that are related to greed and fear. The greed part is, of course, they want as much money as possible so they can spend money and win office. The fear is that people, exactly what you're talking about, people are going to be angry enough with them to vote for the opposition.
Yeah, and for reasons that sometimes don't make sense. I try to tell people, say, if you are looking at a political situation and you're trying to figure out, why is this happening? Why is this going on? you go through this analysis. Here's what politicians, the drivers for politicians.
Mm-hmm.
First, they have to get elected. Then they have to get reelected. And then they want to get power, keep power, and increase power.
Right.
And so that is the driver, basically. And so in a place like Arizona, for example, they're simply responding to the voters, or as they perceive the voters.
Right.
And you know, a different perception, they'd be going the other way. Because I doubt if your average member of the legislature in Arizona, you know, gives two hoots in hell about immigration personally.
Right. Yeah. No, I expect you're right. The fellow who sponsored the legislation probably cares very deeply about it, but the other people who voted for it are doing it exactly as you say because of their perception of the public will and what'll keep them in office. That's the total draw. That's the total motivation.
Yeah, you know, and you never know what motivates people, but my hunch is that there are a lot of things on their agenda that aren't immigration that they may care more about. But
sure.
You know, politically, they may have done exactly the right thing. We'll see. We have an election coming up. You know, the voters will speak.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The odd thing is that the expectation was that everybody around the country would be so aghast at this that they would be screaming and hollering, and certainly there is some screaming and hollering, but I don't want to just dwell on the immigration issue, but the fact is that the majority of the people in the country, according to the polls, although they may not fully understand what's in the law, generally speaking are in favor of it. And,
well, you know, this it's easy to be against immigrants. It's like somebody told me that I believe it was either North Carolina or South Carolina was trying to find a way to tax people for driving through the state. Oh, they were going to put a toll on the highway. That's what it was. They were going to start putting a toll on the highway because it's real easy to tax people who can't vote in a state.
Right.
And it's
that's
you know,
absolutely true.
And
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, even if there had been an outcry around the country, that would have probably made them dig in their heels more to prove that they were not going to be influenced by these outsiders. So, I mean,
right?
Politics is kind of crazy, but it's also very predictable. And
It is.
Say to anybody, and prediction is important in your thinking about influencing outcomes. Because here's what I try to tell people: the world of politics works like the tides. It rolls in and out on a very predictable schedule. So you've got a period between, and I'm not sure, have you had your primaries yet?
Are you talking about here? No. Not yet.
Oh, okay.
Tell you the truth, I don't even know when they are, but they haven't occurred yet. I know that.
Okay. Well, that's a very important date to keep in mind because before the primary is a time when they are really listening carefully to their own voters because it takes very few. All right. So, and then there's a period of time between now and Election Day in November when they're still listening, they're still caring about that, and they're giving speeches on the 4th of July. You can go shake their hand, you know, look them in the eye. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do between now and Election Day, which is pretty simple, which is often fun, which is inexpensive, to make your case, whatever your case is, whether it's for curbside recycling or, you know, Free Willy or whatever. you know, all right, so bear in mind that time frame, all right, now and Election Day. And then right after Election Day is when most people go back to sleep. Now, the smart people, that's when they get to work because now you've got newly elected people or newly reelected people. The legislature's getting organized. The Congress is getting organized. Power may change hands. But now's the time you launch your next effort. And so that's an important period. Then the session starts, whether state or federal, and you have to figure out what you're going to do there. So my point is, if you're trying to make something happen, these time frames are very important for you to keep in mind and construct activities to help you communicate and build relationships with elected office holders.
Because that's the time that they're listening to you.
Right. And,
and especially with regard to the post-election period when they're not hearing from a lot of other voices, as you pointed out.
Right, and they, you know, there's shakeups in the House, shakeups in the Senate maybe, but this is the time to plot your inside strategy for what's going to happen in the legislature or in the Congress and start identifying the key players, what I call the gatekeepers. Because the other truth that people often don't realize is that on most issues, one or two people in the legislature or the Congress are going to be the deciders.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to find some people in those districts. And so, you know, I don't know where the Speaker of the House in Arizona lives, but the people who live in the Speaker's district have incredible ability to make things happen. And, and so if you were trying to get, you know, curbside recycling or something, you find some curbside recycling enthusiast in the Speaker's district.
Right. Because the Speaker of the House in any legislature is a major power.
They could generally do anything they want to. And the challenge, and this is the challenge, this is it. How do you get them to want to do what you want them to do?
Mm-hmm.
So here's another way of looking at it. I try to tell people, I say, Election Day is like the day you hire a new employee.
Right.
You have to give them a job description, and you have to supervise them, or they won't the way you want them to. And
right.
See, most people don't get that. If they even vote, that's all they do. Now,
right.
Smart people who get most of what they want are in there the day after the election day handing over the job description.
By describing what they want to have done by the person who won the election.
Right. Here's what we want you to do. And,
And what you're saying in part is you want to have an organization in place to focus on the issue that's really important to you so that
exactly.
you can get that done.
And here's the other thing. I get a lot of calls from people who say, you know, I want to support curbside recycling or something like that. I'm going to start an organization. I say, no, wait. First, there's probably already somebody fighting for your issue, and you need to merge. You need to merge with them. Get with them. Don't reinvent the wheel. We had a really good example in the last couple of years. There was a woman out in California. Her name was Kate Hanni, H-A-N-N-I. And she became very popular and testified in Washington. And she wanted to rewrite the airline regulations for sitting on the tarmac. Remember those cases where they you know, sat on a plane for 6 hours? Well, she went to her member of Congress, and she proved my point. Her member of Congress immediately introduced the legislation.
Right.
However, it went nowhere because she was kind of attractive. She was articulate. She looked good on TV. She made a lot of noise. She had a great ego trip, but she never built an organization. For example, I kept calling and emailing her saying, look, the guy who's in charge of this lives in southeastern Illinois, across the river from St. Louis. You got to get to him.
Right.
You got to find, you know. Well, she never did anything like that because she wasn't interested in building an organization. And so
she wanted to be on TV. Yeah.
Have you? Well, you know, I don't want to attack her motives. Her heart was in the right place, but have you seen any major changes?
Well, no, I take your point. Obviously, it didn't happen. Although I think they passed a so-called Passenger's Bill of Rights recently with regard to the time on the tarmac, but the changes they made were cosmetic.
Well, they got that one thing, but it's a little squishy, and and I will commend her for, you know, probably having a part in that, but they didn't pass that whole Passenger Bill of Rights by any stretch.
Right.
And, and as you say, it remains to be seen. I think they got the tarmac issue fairly well settled. But anyway, the point being, all of us who fly, could have got a lot more if she had followed my advice of building an organization and focusing on the decision makers. And that's another point that people miss, that many times one or two people can make something happen, and you just have to find them. And the other thing that people miss is the power of staff. Now, it's less true at the state level, but in Washington, your congressional staff has a lot of clout, and you got to focus on them, too.
Right, and, of course, the chairperson of the committees.
Well, that would be the decider. The way Congress works nowadays, the subcommittee chairs have a lot of clout, and you find out which one of those is your man or woman, and that's your go-to guy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let me let you go, Joel. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I've got a minute. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, the frustrating thing is that if you're trying to do airline legislation and the go-to guy lives in southern Illinois, you got to find somebody there who influences that guy, because you in Arizona are not likely to be able to do that. So
find
an organization and work within that, and you may be very surprised at your success.
Right, or at least the fact that you'll get listened to where you otherwise wouldn't. That is the beginning of toward success. Right. Okay, well, it's Joel Blackwell. The name of the book again?
Is Keep on Voting After the Election.
Okay, and that's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all of the usual places. When the next book comes out, drop me a note. We'll get you back on.
Thanks an awful lot, and good luck to you and your listeners.
Thank you very much, Joel. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Righto. Bye-bye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. And that was Joel Blackwell. Again, you can look him up by name on Amazon or Keep on Voting After the Election. That was interesting. I hope you enjoyed it. Before we leave you in about 4 minutes, I want to invite you back next week. We'll have Larry Hancock back on, hopefully to pick up the discussion we never really got going on the assassination of Robert Kennedy that we were going to do last week, and we got kind of waylaid in a good way, but that's that. But for now, here is the endpoint essay. There are some things about which conservatives are correct. Okay, not a lot, but some. Conservatives are frequently saying, we don't live in a democracy, we live in a republic. That's right, and it's not just a semantic or academic distinction. In a democracy, the majority rules, always. In a republic, the majority votes for representatives who then make decisions. When we elect members of the House or Senate, what we're really expressing by our vote is that we believe that that person will exercise judgment that will agree with our own, much of, but not necessarily all the time. If we expect an elected official to always do what the majority wants, why elect them? Especially in modern times, we could put every issue to a public vote over the Internet and set up phone banks for those who have no access to the Internet so they can vote as they do on American Idol. Lately, my liberal brethren and several of my sisters have made a rare showing of either lack of understanding or seeming hypocrisy, and I hope it's the former. The two issues are health care and what we were talking about with Joel, immigration. Many liberals will tell you that even though the health care financing bill was tough to pass, a majority of Americans are in favor of single-payer health care. And they're right. At the same time, they, or maybe I should say we, talk about how awful the Arizona anti-immigrant law is. The problem is that the majority of Americans favor Arizona's new law. Granted, and as we were saying with Joel, if you drill down a little bit into the polling numbers, you'd find that most people who favor the law don't know everything that's in it, but they favor it, and I don't care. If this were a true democracy, majority sentiment would matter far more than it does. More people are Christian than are members of any other religious group in the country, but we have laws in the Constitution that say that fact is unimportant. The rights of minorities, including people who have a minority religion or none, are protected by the government and our courts. If this were a true democracy, there would be no reason for there to be deportation hearings. If anyone can't prove they belong here, the majority would favor shipping them back to wherever they come from, but we don't do that. As said, the majority doesn't matter except at elections, and in the case of presidential elections, sometimes not even then. As an example, if you believe George W. Bush took Florida electoral votes legitimately, and I don't, he still received fewer votes nationally than Al Gore. We're set up as a country with a court system so that someone can challenge the constitutionality of a law. And if it's contrary to our Constitution, the law is rendered moot, even if a majority or a majority of a legislature or Congress voted for it. But the real point is that might doesn't make right. Hitler won an election in Germany, but he wasn't right. Slavery would have been chosen in the South by plebiscite in 1865 or 1870, perhaps. It's always been wrong. Speaking of Hitler, it's always wrong in a democratic society, yes, even one that exists in a republic, for agents of the government to ask to see a person's identification for no other reason than suspicion that that individual might not be here legally. That's especially true when the only basis for suspicion can be, as under Arizona's law, what a person looks like. As a white Anglo who speaks some Spanish and is relatively dark, it might be argued I have a stake. I don't. I'm not concerned about being stopped, but other people shouldn't have to be either. And if the majority favors such a law that works against people of color, they're wrong. Democracy be damned. If you disagree, call us next week and let us know. Have a great week. Thanks for joining us. Make sure to tell all of your friends and some of your enemies where they can find us. And we'll look forward to talking to you and hopefully hearing from you during the next week. Thanks again. Have a great week.